Okay, everyone, so let us have a look at the questions this evening. And if you want to ask any follow-up questions or whatever as we go through, please feel free to do so. It doesn't have to be strictly written questions. We can have a little bit of discussion as well, if you like. So let's see what happens. Lots of questions, that's a good sign. Okay, so we'll see where we get. So, okay, dear Ajahn Brahmali, how difficult was it for you to learn Pali? Thanks for your answer. So, learning Pali, it's weird because I never really considered myself very much of a, you know, very good with languages and things like that. But I realized once I started learning Pali that the reason I didn't really think of myself as good with languages before was because I wasn't really all that interested. And then once I started to learn Pali, I had this really powerful motivation to learn the language, and actually it turned out to be not that difficult. So my teacher of Pali was Ajahn Brahm. This was when I was in Anagarika at Bodhinyana Monastery. This would have been back in 1994, so it's almost 30 years ago. And he taught Pali for one rains retreat, about 3 months. And then after that, I basically just carried on my own. And learned the language using kind of the textbook. There's some nice textbooks and things to use. One is called A.K. Warder's Introduction to Pali, and it's actually it's a bit technical. So if you're not used to linguistic terminology and things, it can be a bit hard going, but if you use the internet and things, you can find the meaning of these words. It depends on your motivation. If you have a strong motivation and you are, you know, reasonably kind of have a reasonable inclination to learn languages, I think you'll be fine. You don't have to be super smart or anything like that. I think most people will be able to do it. But I would say for the majority of Buddhists, it is maybe not an incredibly good use of your time, because depending a bit on your life situation, because it takes time, and it will take time away from other things that you can do. It really, you know, for a monastic, I would recommend learning Pali, but for lay people, normally, I wouldn't recommend it, except under special circumstances, because it takes a lot of time. And the suttas are already well translated by people like Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, and many other translators as well, and you don't really need to learn Pali to understand the content of the suttas. So it gives you a slight advantage to learn Pali, but it's not that much. Yeah. Okay, happy with that answer? Don't know, yeah? Okay, good. Okay, let's move on to the next one. How can one arouse piti in meditation without striving too hard? In what order should piti arise, before or after tranquility? I've heard piti is necessary to sustain the progress and progress of practice. What should one do or not do if they find their practice has plateaued, if they have good tranquility and stillness, but piti is very subtle, thank you. So how can you do it without striving too hard? In fact, piti arises precisely because you don't strive too hard, right? That is how it arises. It arises by the fact that you let go, by the fact of allowing the process to happen by itself. So striving is going to be something that hinders the piti from arising. Yeah. So the idea is just to enjoy the process. And the more you just enjoy it passively, being the passenger on the train, getting the doer out of the way, allowing the meditation to take its own course, the greater is the chance that piti will arise. I think I mentioned this sutta briefly on the first day when I talked about meditation practice. This sutta, which is called the Chaitanya Sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya 10.2 or 10.3, I think it's 10.3, Numerical Discourses, the 10th chapter. And this sutta says specifically, it talks about the psychology of meditation, in other words, the first person experience of meditation. And what it says there, it shows you the progress starting with sila, with morality. From morality comes non-regret or non-remorse. From non-remorse comes pamuja, like a general joy in the mind. From Pamuja comes the piti, which is a more powerful joy, like a rapture, can be felt very, kind of felt like electricity in the body, these kind of things. So that's where rapture comes, right? And then after that comes tranquility, and then comes sukha. So how does it arise? How do you go from each one of these factors to the next one? And the Buddha says specifically in the sutta that this is not to be done by an act of will. Na cetanaya. Cetana is the will, right? Or volition or intention in Buddhism. So it is not to be done by an act of will. Na cetanaya karaniya. That's kind of, it's radical. I was always very surprised when I saw that. And I was very grateful to find it in the suttas because I realized this is exactly what Ajahn Brahm says. It kind of matches, Ajahn Brahm teaches the same way as the Buddha, which is very, kind of very nice. And then the Buddha says that it's not happening through an act of will, but it's happening dhammata. Dhammata means according to nature, according to lawfulness, according to how things are, basically. And of course, if it happens according to the way things are, you can't make it happen. It has to happen by itself. You have to stand back and allow the thing to develop. And the less involved you are, the more likely this process is to happen by itself. So why then does not happen? What can we do to make it happen? Even though we're not supposed to do anything, what can we do? And the answer is that even though you cannot really force the meditation, you can nudge the meditation very gently. Yeah? And when I meditate and when I kind of give instructions, when I say something like, you know, reflect on something, whatever, I don't really mean a lot of thinking, to put a lot of thinking into it. What I mean is a very gentle inclination of the mind, bringing up a perception that you may already have developed in the past. Right? That can be a perception of how wonderful it is to have all these kalyanamitas around you. Yeah, you're here surrounded by good people, and you kind of just that thought is enough to kind of bring clarity and energy to the mind. Or just a general feel of well-being. Well, we're here, we're doing all of these good things, everything's kind of coming together. Wow, this is how I feel so fortunate to be able to take part in this. You know, what a wonderful thing this is. And you feel a sense of uplift because of that. It can be very simple things that give rise to this kind of joy that, you know, something marvelous is happening or whatever. Or it can be, as I mentioned during the talk just now, just the idea of very gently inclining your mind maybe to an action that you did in the past. It is not about thinking a lot about that action, but because you know that you did this, all you have to do is kind of incline the mind in that direction, nudging the mind. Not a lot of activity, but a very gentle kind of inclination. All of this, anything which brings a wholesome sense of joy to the mind can be used. The classic six objects in the suttas are the recollection of the Buddha, recollection of the Dhamma, recollection of the Sangha, recollection of virtue or morality or kindness, recollection of generosity, and the last one is a recollection of the devatas, the devas, which is kind of strange. I'm not going to talk about that now. But this is all good. It can be an act of just feeling gratitude, for the fact of being here, having this beautiful opportunity. All of these things are spiritual joys. It has to be spiritual joy. You can't, you know, if you find joy in some worldly thing, it's not going to work. It has to be a spiritual kind of joy. All of these things are spiritual joys. And then, if your mind is ready, something will happen. If your mind isn't ready, well, it may not work. And I mean, that's often the case. But you have to kind of train your mind to see in this way. And as you do that, things will start to happen. What comes first, tranquility or piti? Well, the reality is that these things grow together, and it grows together all the way on the path. So the moment you start to meditate and you start hopefully to calm down, so a little bit of tranquility happens right away. And then at some point, some gladness will arise. So a bit of gladness is coming, and then you feel more tranquility, and then the piti may arise. From the piti then comes more tranquility, even more happiness, even more tranquility. So the idea of tranquility and happiness, or tranquility and joy, these are the two main qualities by which you know that you're heading in the right direction. So both of these qualities should strengthen as you do your practice. More joy, more piti gradually. More joy, more tranquility gradually building up. So even if you feel just a little bit of tranquility in your meditation, you're on the right track. That's enough to know that you are doing something positive, you're heading in the right direction. If you get some joy as well, marvelous. Many people find it hard to give rise to joy. Don't despair if that doesn't happen. Sometimes you need a bit of time to get to that point. But it is there, yeah, available, if you do practice in the right way. So two things, tranquility and joy building up. Other things, energy. Yeah, there should be energy in the mind. Energy will also kind of build up over time. Mindfulness, yeah, mindfulness will build up, become stronger as your mind becomes more clear. You can see things more clearly. You can feel more present as these things build up. Because when the joy starts to arise, it's a very powerful magnet for the mind. And the mind wants to be present, right? You get drawn to the present in this way. So these are all qualities that arise. Vipassana becomes stronger. You have more clear seeing. You see things more clearly as these things happen. Okay, I've forgotten what the question is, but let me. I think I. I heard piti is necessary to sustain and progress the practice. Yes, if you really want to progress the mindfulness of breathing, piti is one of the aspects of mindfulness of breathing that you kind of need to go through, if you like. Yeah, it's part of the practice. And it's wonderful that this is part of the practice, right? Joy is a necessary part of the practice. Please don't be afraid of these joys. This is what makes the practice so interesting and exciting, that we have these things. So if your practice has plateaued, well, then you try to use these contemplations and reflections so that you actually can give rise to some kind of piti. So you try to use these reflections that I've been talking about and see if that works for you. In general, it's also the practice of the overall path, doing this over long periods of time. If you have practiced the path, maybe you have recently come to Buddhism, it may take a while before all the factors kind of come together powerfully. So keep on practicing kindness in your ordinary life. Have more ideas of right view. Align your mind with the way the Buddha looks at the world more and more. And as these things come together, these things will start to happen in your meditation. But you have to take it very seriously. You have to make this the number one priority in your life. Only then is it really going to work. This has to be what your life really is about. Yes, you have to work. Yes, you have to do your family things, whatever it is that you have. All of these things are part of life. But you imbue all of those activities with spiritual values. And when you do that, everything kind of comes together very beautifully. The spiritual practice should be number one priority for anyone who is serious about this path. The beautiful thing about that is that everything improves if you do that. Yeah, your family life improves, your work life improves, because if we imbue all of that with spiritual qualities, of course it's going to be better, because you are more kind, you are more caring, you are more compassionate. So everything kind of comes together. So this is how important it is if you really want to practice this path. You make your life into a spiritual path in a sense. And then every year, every 6 months, whatever it is, you come back, you do a meditation retreat. You can do one, do a retreat which is a little bit more focused on meditation than this one as well. Whatever works for you. And then you get a test to see if the path is working for you in the right way. And if you find that it is not happening, your mindfulness is not improving, at least you know that you are stagnating. Like, okay, so what do I need to do then? And then you can change your... Sometimes we go through difficult times. And of course, if you go through a difficult time, that may be the reason why you're stagnating. It's very hard to sustain that mindfulness, that joy, if things are conspiring against you. And we all have times in our life that are difficult. This is just the nature of human existence. So you need to take that into account as well. But the general trend should be upwards. Okay, are there inspiring monks or nuns alive today in addition to Ajahn Brahm who you would recommend listening to? There are many, many kind of inspiring people out there. It's funny with Ajahn Brahm, because sometimes people think Ajahn Brahm is just a joker and he kind of tells stories and that sort of thing. But Ajahn Brahm is a very profound person. I sit next to him all the time, and he is one of the emptiest people I know. He's really empty here. You sit next to him, it's like you feel there's no one there. It's a very strange feeling here. It's palpable, right? It's most people, we emanate a kind of sense of self in the world. Yeah, I'm here. Yeah, so kind of become visible in the world. But Ajahn Brahm, it isn't like that. He kind of disappears. It's beautiful, very beautiful to see that. And he experiences, he says he's always quite close to samadhi. His mind is always inclining to samadhi. So when he goes back to his kuti, it doesn't take long before his meditation takes hold again. And you can see that if you know him well. He's this very, very happy person, right? Always ready to say something joyful and happy and these kind of things. And I think one of the reasons why he is, you know, tells so many jokes and stories when he gives talks is because it's just he can't take things too seriously, right? He just kind of bubbles over with, he wants to just share something happy and something funny. And that's kind of the way he is. So he is, you know, he's one of my heroes, if you like, Ajahn Brahm. There are other monks as well who have a very good reputation. One of the monks that I sometimes visit is a monk called Ajahn Ganha in Thailand. He has a monastery about an hour and a half from Bangkok, close to a national park. And he's actually the nephew of Ajahn Chah. And he is... I can't really say exactly where he is on the path, but he has this incredible metta, and you just sit next to him and you kind of feel really at ease in his presence because he's so kind. And if you are an Ajahn Brahm disciple, he really looks after you. When I go there, he kind of looks after me like I'm royalty or something. So that's kind of nice as well. And he's funny. I don't know. You may have heard these stories before, but he has this large bowl of sweets next to him, like this enormous bowl of sweets. I mean, it's massive. And he has these monks behind him always pouring more sweets into this bowl. And then he has this dipper that he dips into the sweets, right? And there's a crowd of people in front of him. And he throws out the sweets onto the crowd. It's kind of raining with sweets. And it's kind of symbolic, right? Because he's such a sweet monk. And then the sweetness kind of rains down. It's kind of a nice symbolic thing. And everyone scrambles to get hold of these sweets. And then, of course, you take those sweets, and the nice thing about it, you take those sweets, and then you bring them back home, and it reminds you, right, of this teacher, and it reminds you of those metta qualities and all of that. So it kind of has a beautiful effect, right? And so it sounds kind of weird when you hear about it, but when you're there, it's actually quite nice, it's quite natural. This is the weird thing, that if someone is very spiritually powerful, they can do things that normal people can't do, and it feels fine, right? And this is the weird thing. There's a story, this is the same monk, by the way, who he was staying at Bodhinyana Monastery for about a year back in the Ajahn Ganha. Ganha. And he was staying at Bodhinyana Monastery for about a year back in the late 1980s. And this was when they were building up all the buildings at Bodhinyana Monastery, and they were dependent on the local shire. Do you call it shire here in the US? The local government, to give them permission to building and all of these kind of things. And so Ajahn Ganha was in the monastery, and one day the mayor of the local shire comes into the monastery, right? And you have to treat the mayor nicely, otherwise he won't give you permission to build, right? You can't do the wrong thing. Ajahn Ganha is a Thai monk, right? He doesn't understand Western customs, right? So Ajahn Brahm is a bit concerned. And so this mayor comes in a suit, and this is a kind of Australian man. He's got a big tummy here, right? He's kind of been eating, I don't know what he's been eating, kind of barbecues and drinking too many beers or whatever, and he's kind of got a big Australian tummy. It comes into the monastery, and then Ajahn Ganha is the first to see him, right? So he comes up to Ajahn Ganha, and Ajahn Brahm is kind of sees this in the distance. He's getting a bit concerned. What is going to happen now when this Thai monk who doesn't speak a word of English meets this kind of Australian mayor who doesn't speak a word of Thai? So how is the chemistry going to work here? And so this man, this mayor comes in, and Ajahn Gandha sees him. And Ajahn Gandha looks at his tummy. His tummy is very impressive tummy, right? This large tummy. So Ajahn Gandha is such a super sweet monk, yeah, so much metta. He takes his hand out and starts patting him on the tummy. And Ajahn Brahm goes, no, this is it. We are finished. No more buildings in this monastery. You can't go patting people on the tummy. That's kind of not considered the right way, right? But of course, what happens, because of the metta and the kindness, this kind of this mayor, he starts to gurgle like a baby, according to Ajahn Brahm, right? He's just so happy being patted on the tummy by this monk, right? And according to Ajahn Brahm's story, I don't really trust those Ajahn Brahm stories, but anyway, Ajahn Brahm always exaggerates. Ajahn Brahm has one of these sayings that never let the truth get in the way of a good story. That's kind of Ajahn Brahm's saying. Yeah. But what he says after that, no more problems. Are we getting permission for buildings? After that, you know, everything was fine. So, and there's many more stories with Ajahn Gandha. I won't tell any more because otherwise we're going to be here all night. But so this is kind of thing, right? And this is what you can expect almost when someone has so much good qualities. So he is really interesting. So maybe go and check him out if you're ever in Thailand. You happen to be in Thailand anyway, for whatever reason. I don't know how often. People probably don't go to Thailand that often. But even if you want to do a separate trip just to meet some of these people, it's really worthwhile because you get to see something here that is very rare and difficult to see in the world. There's also a monk called... No, men and women. You can stay in the monastery as a lady. Yeah, you have to be a little bit careful with your how you do things. This is in Thailand, so the conduct is a bit different from what probably used to here in the US. So you have to be a bit culturally sensitive, of course. But I'm sure you know that already. It's kind of obvious. So you know, you don't go and give him a hug, for example. That would be interesting if you tried that, see what happens. So he is one of these very interesting characters. There's another monk who is now the abbot of Wat Pa Phong at Dan Chao's old monastery, Ajahn Lumpu Liem, Ajahn Liem. He is a very interesting monk as well, and very... I don't know him all that well, but he has a very, very good reputation as well for being very well practiced and being having lots of insights into the Dhamma and these things. So also worthwhile visiting, I would say. So now, what about the nuns? Yeah, because there are some very inspiring nuns in the world as well. And one of the nuns who is kind of very well known for her good practice is an English nun called Tenzin Palmo, who you may have heard of. She has kind of spent a lot of time in solitude. I don't really know her myself, but she has a good reputation. It's hard. It's always a bit dangerous to kind of just go on reputation when you haven't met them. But she may very well be worthwhile visiting. We have the... Tenzin Palmo, Palmo, P-A-L-M-O, yeah. There's also the abbot of our Dhammasara monastery in Perth. She's also actually a very nice nun. She's very well practiced, has a very good meditation practice. She's always, I don't know, I'm actually quite inspired by her. She is she's a small little Asian nun. She comes from Malaysia originally. And she grew up in a small town in Malaysia called Ipoh. And her English is okay, but not all that good, all that great. Yeah, if you come from Malaysia, she's just used to speaking Chinese, basically, or maybe Malay, the local languages. She comes to Perth. Yeah, she hasn't. And in Malaysia, it's a very hierarchical society. The monks are on top, and then the men, and I think the women are kind of fairly low down in this hierarchy in Malaysia. She comes to Perth, ordains as a nun. She's already in her 50s. And then she's always kind of bubbling, and then she takes charge of Dhammasara Monastery, runs this whole monastery. And then we ask her to give talks, and she gets on the seat and she gives talks, even though her language abilities aren't that great. All this confidence, I don't know where it comes from, all this confidence. It must come from something inside, right? There's something... So I must admit, she has really inspired me, because her background sort of tells me that she shouldn't really have these qualities, but she's got them. And that's kind of marvelous. So I find that quite inspiring, to be honest. And I have always been very, yeah, I've, you know, anyway. So that, and if you go to certain monasteries in Thailand, there are some of these Thai nuns who also have a good reputation, but I'm not really an expert on these things, unfortunately. You might be better off asking some nuns about who are the most interesting nuns to visit, and I don't really have that inside information, so much of it anyway. You hear about them sometimes, but it's strange because, you know, Buddhism tends to segregate a little bit on gender, right? Because monasteries are different for nuns and monks, so you don't have that same access to nuns as you have to monks. But I have made the point every year of inviting Ajahn Hasapanya, who is the abbot of Dhammasala Monastery, to give a talk at Bodhinyana. Ajahn Brahma is on retreat. I say, please come over and give a talk to the monks. So we have done that a few times, and that's actually very interesting. And, you know, she has no problem giving a talk to the monks. And it's kind of interesting to hear the Dhamma from the point of view of a nun, because gender means that you experience the world slightly differently. So it's kind of fascinating to hear from that point of view. And so, yeah. Anyway, so I hope that helps. All right. Okay, so please offer some guidance on how to speak to someone who is unkind. Unkind. Cruel, okay, or even abusive to myself or to others, especially to children. Metta.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, how do you speak to them there? I guess with kindness. So this is one of those things, but how do you change other people? This is what this really is about. How do we change other people?
Well, we might not change them, but what do we say? We might not change them.
Right, so what do you say, whether they, exactly, but how do we...
We can't be attached to the outcome, of course.
Right, but how do we kind of make the most, how do we kind of maximize the potential for change? Is that what you're meaning?
Children, that's the hard part for me.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the first things, obviously, is that if you want to change someone else, try to change and not be attached to the outcome, as you say, which is exactly the right attitude, so well done, is first of all, you have to make the person feel that you have their best interest at heart. If they feel that you just want to blame them, they're not going to listen. And of course, if someone is unkind to children, they probably have some issues themselves, right? So they probably have some suffering inside. So see that suffering in them, understand that they have a problem as well, and then we can maybe resolve many people's problems in one go. Then there's a chance you will reach them. So that is really the first thing, to give them that sense. So you sound like a very kind-hearted person, to be honest. So maybe you may have the ability to reach that person because of you, because you come from
that
position.
That's my soul side, is the children, because I don't have an effect on how people treat children.
Right, exactly.
I do have some effect on how they treat adults, but
So you know, approach them at the right time in the right place, and let them know your observations or whatever, and you know, say something in the right way, and then the may, as you say, may not have an impact. It's very, very hard to say, really. So that is
more, yes, you know, like, hey, what's happening, what's going on? More questions,
right?
Okay,
good, yeah, excellent, yeah. So find out what's happening exactly.
Yeah, what's going on?
Yeah,
hey, what's happening?
Great. I think you have the right attitude, you know. So, yeah, and then you will understand their side of the question, and then kind of maybe you can find a solution together or something like that. Yeah, that's the way to do things. But, I mean, it really depends on how harsh the abuse is. If it is a lot of abuse going on, well, then you should have to report it, because otherwise you're allowing something to go on. So even though you may not actually want to report it because you feel bad about it, and so would I as well, to report it, sometimes we just have that obligation, you know, because the larger picture is more important.
Well, the children need our help. We can't have our own opinions. They need our help.
Yeah, Precisely, exactly. And that's the same thing in Buddhism. If there's abuse going on in Buddhism, we should also say something about it. It's not right to cover it up. There's a lot of covering up happening in Buddhist circles when there's abuse. It's a bad idea. And there is, in Buddhism as well, there's a fair amount of abuse going on here. So it's important to be aware of that and actually deal with it when it happens. So, so I think you, I don't know, I tend to agree with you. I think you know more than I already, so that's good. Yeah.
It's good to ask people questions rather than tell them what you think you know,
like that. Right, yeah. I agree. And so even if you think you know it already, you ask and then you kind of maybe get something additional, something, so yeah, indeed, yeah. Yeah, good point. All right, next one. What led you to the path? Okay, to not answer it too personal, okay. What has been the greatest challenge, the greatest joy? Okay. What led me to the path? Okay, there is a book on the internet called Why I Am a Buddhist Monk. Mm. Check it out. It has my name on it, and Why I Am a Buddhist Monk. And it tells you the story of why I kind of chose this strange life. And to summarize, it's very, very hard to explain. If I look at my upbringing, I was brought up in a society where there were no Buddhists, exactly zero Buddhists around me. My parents were certainly not interested in Buddhism. And still, there was something inside of me which was kind of leaning in a spiritual direction. Initially, I didn't even know what it was. I couldn't name it as Buddhism or anything. It was something inside of me which was weird. And I had some strange experiences when I was young. Things that showed me that there was something, I couldn't really explain them from this life. Yeah, why do I, as a young child, inclined towards solitude? I want to be in the forest by myself, that kind of stuff, just in the hut. I couldn't really explain these things. And later on, I am pretty sure that the reason why these things are happening is probably because I've been a monastic in a past life. Yeah, this is not the first time I'm a Buddhist monastic. I've done this before. And that's a strange kind of experience when you kind of feel that that is actually what is driving you. Because on the one hand, it's a bit of a concern. It's like, am I doing this purely out of habit? Yeah? I'm a habitual monastic. I'm just doing it because I did it in the past. And that kind of gets you worried because so many of our habits are, is this a good reason for doing this? But if you think about it in the right way, then you realize, initially it feels like maybe it's a trap, right? Because I'm doing it out of habit. So what that does to you, if you think about it correctly, it does to you, it makes you investigate the Buddha's teachings even more to make sure that you really want to do this. And that is, of course, what I have been doing. I've been reading the suttas backwards and forwards in Pali, Norwegian and English, and all of these ways to make sure that this really is what I want to do. And so that has kind of spurred me on the path of really trying to understand Buddhism and practicing it properly. Some of the things that have come from this idea of thinking that I was a monastic in a past life. And this was very interesting for me. And this was this, well, if I really was a monastic in a past life, where did it come from? Right? This is, for me, is very interesting. Well, if I was a monastic in a past life, where would I have been a monastic? Yeah, and I would have been a monastic in Asia somewhere, right? If I was a monastic in a past life, was I maybe a nun in a past life? So maybe I was a nun in Asia somewhere, maybe in Sri Lanka, yeah, maybe China, who knows, somewhere in Asia. And once you see yourself as an Asian nun, right, it takes a very, you start to look at yourself in a very different way, right? And it's actually very powerful because what it means, it takes away so much of the barriers that exist between us as people. Because we tend to group ourselves together according to gender, according to nationality, according to culture, according to all of these things that separate each other from each other. But if you see in yourself all of those other things in the world and you see those as inside of you, okay, right now I look like this, but in a past life I look completely different. If you see that inside of you, it breaks down so much of these barriers between us. And when I look at someone else, like a woman or someone from a different background, someone from a Sri Lankan background or Chinese background, or whatever it might be, I can see myself in that person. This was me in the past, and this may be me again in the future, unless I make an end of all of this rebirth business, right? And that's kind of powerful, because once you see yourself, or you go through the streets of New York, and you see these beggars, and you see yourself in that beggar, I have been there before. I have been probably sitting on the street before like this. And then it's really painful when you see it in that way. It's really, really painful, because then you kind of identify with that suffering of that person in a completely different way. And so this opens your heart, I think, to humanity when you understand this. Instead of, in the modern day, we have this idea of, you know, we separate ourselves into subgroups, and this idea of our identity. We take our identity so seriously. My identity is like this, and this is my identity. No one else can understand me because this is my identity, or whatever it is. But I don't think, from a Buddhist point of view, that's a very wise thing to do. I think, from a Buddhist point of view, it's far more important to actually know that all of these identities are already inside of us. We have been there before. We will go there again in the future. We do have the capability, not fully perhaps, but to a large extent, to actually understand other people's suffering, other people's problems. People who are LGBT, of course we can understand people who are that. We have been there before. And once you start to see this, you don't want to discriminate against anyone, because if you discriminate against somebody, you are discriminating against yourself. Because you have been there, you are all of these things. And so this opens up a view of the world, which to me is very powerful and very useful. And you start to treat people just like people, whoever they are, and you stop kind of making these distinctions between people in the world. So this is just a little bit of the thing. So I think I was a Buddhist monastic in the past life. What has been the greatest challenge? Well, the greatest challenge is always when, there's always times when the path is not really working all that well, when you feel miserable, when you feel the world is treating you badly. My fellow monks, why are they so terrible? And so... You know what it's like? This is kind of life for you, life in a shed. It's always like that. And when that happens, you lose your inspiration on the path. And when you lose your inspiration on the path, lay life starts to look very attractive again. Yeah? Maybe a relationship. Wow, that would be nice. These are the things that happen for everyone, I think, or most people. Maybe not for Ajahn Brahm, but it happens for most people on the spiritual path occasionally, right? This is just natural. The greatest joy of the spiritual life is that you have a profound sense of meaning. This is really, really meaningful. The problem for me with kind of lay life is that it seems, I'm sorry to say this, I don't want to offend anyone, but it seems, from my point of view, it seems a bit pointless. There's so many of you, I'm only one. I have to be careful what I say. You might beat me up or something if I say the wrong thing, right? So, okay. But it's at least once you are a monk, why return to lay life? Of course, if you are a lay person, you make the most out of it and you actually make it meaningful. Of course, you can do that. But there is nothing really in lay life that is useful for the spiritual path that I cannot find in monastic life. Monastic life really has all the advantages if the spiritual path is the way to go. So returning to lay life seems like a step backwards, right? If you're going to have something meaningful. So this to me is by far the greatest thing. You have a powerful sense of meaning. And you have a powerful opportunity to share this meaning with the world, right? I mean, you have as a monastic, one of the greatest things to do is be able to share the Dhamma, to teach. You go into solitude, then you become a public figure for a while, you go back into solitude again. It's this beautiful kind of back and forth. This is one of the nice challenges of the monastic life, this fact that you have this both solitude. It's a very balanced life in many ways. Solitude, public, study, meditation, and also some physical work to keep the body reasonably healthy. Yeah? It has a lot of kind of, it's a very balanced kind of lifestyle. Yeah? I don't know if it looks like balance to you, but that's what it feels like to me. Yeah? You probably think it's extreme, right? Kind of, but it isn't really extreme. Some monastics live it in an extreme way, but actually I reckon it's very nice and balanced. Anyway, let's go on to the next one. Can you recommend suttas, articles, or books that explain in detail the Theravadan concept of rebirth? What gets reborn? How does rebirth happen? Thank you. It is found in the suttas to some extent, right? The idea of rebirth. You can read various suttas and you kind of have to kind of piece it a bit together because it kind of looks in various places. But the main idea that explains the rebirth is really dependent origination in Buddhism. Paticca Samuppada, that is the process that drives rebirth. It is a very interesting idea, Paticca Samuppada, dependent origination, but it's also quite profound. But just Google it, dependent origination. There are nice books by people like Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi. We did a whole workshop in Perth on dependent origination. Check it out online, and listen to that and see if you can get something out of it. The website to go to is bswa.org, BSWA, Buddhist Society, Western Australia, bswa.org, and you will find a whole workshop there that we did on dependent origination. That is really the mechanism behind rebirth that drives this whole process. So if you understand that, you will have a good idea of what it, how it works. So what gets reborn? Well, I can maybe give a little bit of idea of how to think about these things right now, so you can read about it later on. So what gets reborn? Well, what gets reborn is just the stream of consciousness, right? The consciousness is like a stream. And that stream is already there in this life, right? If you look at yourself, the way you were 10 years ago compared to who you are now, is it the same person? Is it a different person? Well, it's both the same and different. There's change and there is continuity happening simultaneously. This is like the stream of consciousness, moving on in time. And the stream that exists within this life is exactly the same stream that goes from one life to the next one. There's no difference. So in your next life, again, you will be both change and continuity. And that is why if you remember a past life, you will say, that was me, because there's continuity and there's change, just like there is in this life. So it is just the kind of the mind that carries on. And you may think, well, if the body dies, then the mind should come to a stop, right? But this is because we take the body far too seriously. The body just isn't that important. What really matters in the world is the mind. The mind is far more fundamental than the body. The mind is primary. The body is, as from a Buddhist point of view, is just really secondary. And so the fact the mind should die when the body dies doesn't really make any sense. It's more like the body is an appendage to the mind rather than the mind being an appendage to the body. So we need to reverse our ideas about these things. So of course, when the body dies, the mind, if it still craves, it will carry on, because craving is something that projects you into the future. Because craving and desire is always about the future. And so you project yourself into the future because you crave more existence, you crave more life, you crave all of these things that we have. And so that projection happens, and then you carry on and you kind of move on into the future because of that. This is the basic idea. This is the idea that you find in the Second Noble Truth, which says that tanha is craving. Pornobhavika means rebirth leading. The rebirth leading craving is the cause of suffering. Right? So craving is the cause of suffering does not mean that I crave now, therefore I suffer straight away. The idea here is that you crave now, it leads to rebirth, and the whole process of suffering is kept going via rebirth. That is the real issue. and I think often not taught well enough in Buddhism in the West. Often in the Buddhism in the West, we psychologize these things and you say that because you crave, then you suffer. But that is not really what the Second Noble Truth is about. It's about the whole idea of the process of rebirth. That is really what it is about. So this is, I'm giving you real Buddhist teachings, right? This is not kind of dodgy stuff or kind of the half truth. This is the absolute, the real deal you're getting here. Isn't that good? You're getting the real deal? I mean, isn't that what we want? Yeah? No more holding back. Yeah? No more kind of shying away from reality. Yeah? So if you don't like it, tough luck, you know. I'm being very naughty now, but, you know, I have to tell you what I see as the Buddhist teachings, otherwise I'm not doing my job, basically. Yeah. So, there you are. This is a little bit of a... on that topic. So let's move on. Dear Ajahn, earlier you spoke about confidence, sadha, in the Buddha's teachings as well as teachers in looking at what and how they teach. Sometimes I come across monks or teachers that don't outwardly appear that happy or peaceful themselves. I don't want to judge them, but sometimes I lose confidence when I feel this way. How should I properly approach this discernment of monks or teachers? Thank you. So, it is possible to be a reasonably good teacher without necessarily being a very profound meditator. These things don't always go together, right? And sometimes it can also be that someone may have many good qualities. Okay, people are on all different stages of the path, even as monastics. It depends on where they were when they started out, how far they have gone, and all of these kind of things. So there's many different ways of dealing with that. So if you find that they have some good qualities and they teach well, you can still listen to them as teachers. But if you don't feel inspired, of course, then there's not much point, because it's the inspiration that drives often our understanding of these teachings. If you feel that a teacher is inspiring, then you will listen, then you will take on board what they are saying. So having some degree of inspiration is important, and it matters. So it doesn't mean that you should reject these monks or teachers, or kind of. But maybe, if you don't feel inspired, maybe it is not really... your teacher in that case. Maybe you find someone else who you feel inspires you. That's been very important in my life, the idea of it being inspired. And this is one of the reasons why I chose Ajahn Brahm as my teacher, because he was to me really inspiring. I started out my monastic career actually in the UK. I was in some monasteries over there. And then someone brought me a teaching by Ajahn Brahm, and I knew straight away, this is my teacher. Straight away I knew it. I could hear from the way he spoke. Here is someone who speaks with confidence. Someone who speaks as if they know exactly what they're talking about. I was used to teachers who used kind of nice words and they were very friendly and they were doing the right thing. But they didn't have the confidence. I didn't really feel that they knew what they were talking about. But suddenly I came across someone who really felt absolutely solid. Yeah, there was something very powerful about Ajahn Brahm. And so I just took the telephone, called Ajahn Brahm, said, can I come to Australia? And he said, sure, and I went to Australia. That was all. That was kind of the whole thing, and I've been there ever since. So that was one of my kind of key career moves as a monk. It was a very, very good move. And so this, to me, this has been very important. And it's important to remember that, yes, knowing the suttas is very significant, but sometimes it can be hard to be inspired by the suttas because they can seem a bit dry, right? If you can be inspired by the suttas, great, wonderful, but not everyone can do that. And then what we may need is a live teacher who can inspire us. So that is why inspiration is so important. And the Buddha says this in the suttas, right? You shouldn't just read suttas dryly as kind of, just for the sake of it. You should listen to these teachings to find inspiration. That is what a Dhamma is really for. Knowledge is one thing. Inspiration is a second thing. Inspiration is what drives the meditation process and makes the path work. Atta Veda, Dhamma Veda, you find in the suttas. Inspiration in the meaning, the goal of the teachings. Inspiration in the Dhamma itself. These things come together here. So, yes, So don't reject these teachers or monks or whatever it is who don't inspire you. Don't reject them and think that they are bad or worthless. That is not really necessarily the case at all. But just know that you don't feel inspired by them. That's okay, right? And then you kind of try to find some inspiration somewhere else. Don't hold on too much to any individual teacher. If you hold on too much to any individual teacher, you may end up very disappointed because it is very hard for you to judge what a person really is like. Yeah, I don't know how you judge me, but it's very difficult for you to know what I'm like just by seeing me here for a few days. Very, very difficult. And it may be that, you know, what's going on behind the facade, you have no idea what's going on behind the facade. Right? That's the truth. That's the reality. Let's be honest about it. And so the danger of grasping too much onto a teacher is that you could end up very disappointed. So take the Buddha's teaching as your prime kind of teaching. And then, yes, be inspired by monastics or any teacher without holding on too hard to who they are. Otherwise, you may be setting yourself up for a big fall. And this has happened to many, many people in the world. Been very disappointed. Sometimes they lose all their faith in Buddhism as a consequence. Okay, so I hope that is helpful. Next one. Okay, according to Ajahn Brahm's books, okay, he seems to say that the light or nimitta is not present in jhana. I've seen other traditions disagree with this. I would love to hear from you. So the jhana states, when they become really profound, they are called ekatta. And ekatta means like oneness, unification. Right? So oneness really means that the mind is completely unified, so that there isn't really any distinction anymore between subject and object. There's only experience, one single experience. So I would say that when I hear Ajahn Brahm say that you come to the nimitta, then you go beyond the nimitta, that is how you enter a jhana, that seems to be the right explanation, right? Because this is a oneness of the mind that jhana really is about. So one of the things about the jhanas on the path is that they are very profound. The Buddha describes them as the uttari manusadhamma. It means like states or qualities beyond ordinary human qualities. He calls them the alang arya nanadasana visesa, the distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. He calls it the sambodha sukha, happiness of awakening. Right? And so the jhanas are placed in the suttas on par with the four stages of awakening everywhere. You have the four jhanas and you have the four stages of awakening, and they are basically considered as a group, yeah? Eight things, four jhanas, four stages of awakening. Yeah? They are called the footsteps of the Buddha, the Tathagata Pada. Right, the footsteps of the Buddha. You must be joking, that must be very profound, right? When you come to a jhana, you know the Buddha was here. The Buddha would have been through this, because this is so profound. This is the kind of thing the Buddha would have done. So these are really, really profound things. And people have a tendency to underestimate the jhanas. And you do that at your peril, because what it means is that very likely you will not be able to go all the way to the end of this path. So I have always had confidence in Ajahn Brahm, because no one has really explained the jhanas in more depth than he has. And this to me was actually fitted very well with how the suttas explain these things. So yes, I would say that you have to go beyond. As long as the light is there, the sensory world is not far behind. If the light is there, sometimes you may be able to hear things and that sort of thing. But really, it is when the five senses disappear, that is when you enter the jhanas. Viviceva kamehi. Viviceva kamehi. Vivicha means separated from. Kamehi. Kama is often translated as sensuality, but kamehi is plural. And in the plural form, it means the five senses. Separated from the five senses. That is the description of the first jhana. So that is my take on it. And
please,
yeah.
How easy or how difficult is it to experience jhana, enter jhana?
Easy.
Easy.
Extremely easy. It's the easiest thing in the world. We make it difficult. It's because we are so complicated.
And
so, yeah.
So
yeah.
People that have meditated all their life but never experienced jhana.
Yeah.
You know, what about them then?
Because they complicated too much. They
It's
interesting when you ask someone who is a really good meditator, they say, "Ah, jhana is the easiest thing in the world. Just sit back, wait, bang, you go into jhana." And the reason why it doesn't work is because you haven't, the basic foundation is not strong enough yet. That's really why it doesn't work. Yeah. So you just have to come back and make the foundation really stronger. Yeah. Come back to the idea of more metta, more kindness, more compassion, more right view, all of these things. Build the foundation, build the foundation. If the foundation isn't strong enough, it's not difficult, it's impossible. Can't be done, right? It's impossible because the mind isn't ready. If the mind is ready, it happens by itself. If the mind isn't ready, can't do it. So it's not difficult. Difficult is the wrong kind of word. It's more about being ready, having laid the foundation for these things to happen. Then it will happen. Yeah? Please, sir. Yeah?
So is jhana and higher state of meditation, are those the only state where you leave your senses? Or there are other states where you also don't have your senses?
Well, there's all the stages beyond jhana, like the immaterial attainments, those kind of things.
Yeah.
You know, that's also part of it. But basically, the jhanas is where you leave the senses behind. Yeah. I mean, you can temporarily, you know, you go into meditation and you see lights and you whatever, you can temporarily kind of the five senses feel like they're gone, but they're still there in the background. They can reappear very quickly and easily again. But in a jhana state, they are kind of gone for a long time and they can't really reappear as long as you are in that state. Yeah. So, yeah. Okay. Okay, still a few questions to go, so let's see what happens. So, how does an arahant perceive what ordinary people will consider beautiful, like a sunset on a beach, a flower, a person, woman, the world would consider beautiful? So, an arahant, or the noble ones, and this is kind of fascinating, they are actually able to enjoy the sensory world more than ordinary people. And this is kind of the really paradoxical thing, because you think, the way we normally think about the sensory world, well, if you enjoy it, then surely you crave for it and you desire it. But actually, no, that is not how it works. If you take the craving out of the equation, if you take the desire out, that enhances your ability to enjoy things, because the craving actually destroys your ability to enjoy, because the craving is always in the future. It is always somewhere else. You can't enjoy what you have. And so very fascinating when you see in the suttas, you read about someone in the jhana state, it is the people who, when they come out of the jhana, that is when you enjoy your food the most. It's kind of weird, isn't it? And that's when you think, you know, it says, even if you have this very simple meal of porridge and broken rice, that's what they're kind of the standard kind of word for the most basic food in the suttas. It's like a king's meal, right? Wow, this is so nice. So you go back to your little hut in the forest, it's like a palace to you. Or your robes are like, wow, this kind of really nice robe. So your ability to enjoy the sensory world is actually enhanced. But you don't crave for it. And that is really the kind of the important point. So you enjoy it without craving. And this is kind of the weird thing here. So an arahant would absolutely be able to enjoy a sunset, but without any kind of attachment, any kind of craving. A flower, absolutely. A person, let's say an arahant woman, would she be able to see a man as handsome? Would an arahant man see a woman as beautiful? Probably not. Yeah, because that there is very, very much related to defilements usually. Seeing someone else as attractive, you might be able to see maybe a little bit of it, a little bit, you can maybe make a difference between someone who is kind of, I mean, to some extent maybe, yeah, because, you know, someone might be considered objectively ugly because maybe they had a bad accident, so their shape is face is misshapen or something like that. So much of what we see in a person who we are attracted to comes from defilements of desire. And so an Arahant would probably treat people very much the same, regardless of how they look, regardless of the gender. And that is actually very nice. One of the wonderful things about, you know, being around someone like Ajahn Brahm, whether you are a woman or a man, whatever you look like, he will treat you the same. There's no sense that he has any, you know, there's nothing there which can, for any reason, that he would treat you differently. And that's kind of very liberating in a sense. You are no longer limited by your appearance or your gender or anything else that you may look like. You're a human being, he will treat you as a human being. And that's, when I see that, I see the interaction, how Ajahn Brahm interacts with people, I think, yeah, that's really nice. That's the way it should be.
I was wondering, yeah? If they could see beauty, but not attach it to a person. In other words, there's beauty,
yeah,
beauty on this image, but not attach it to a person. But just, oh, there's beauty. There's something like that?
Something like that, yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I think.
It's just a guess.
Yeah.
In other words, with beauty without the attachment, right? It's like, oh, yeah, there's beauty, but it's like, oh, that person, wow. You know what I mean? Like that.
I think a lot of what we see when we see beauty in people actually comes from desire and attachment. It's actually related to that. And that the beauty is, maybe there is some objectiveness there, but not that much. It's mostly subjective. And I think it's Arahants will largely just see people.
It's not quite like a sunset.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but yeah. Anyway, yeah. But that's another thing, right? It was very interesting. It's very kind of very culturally specific. And you kind of look at some of the ideals of beauty. You see paintings from kind of the Middle Ages and people really chubby, right? That was considered beautiful in those days. So kind of, yeah, back and forth and very variable. When some cultures, being really pale is beautiful. In other ones, you have to kind of have a good, you know, you have to be much more brown or whatever. So it kind of bang varies a lot. Anyway, let's move on. Dear Ajahn, the general landscape of Buddhist practice in the U.S. is confusing to me here. Yeah, well, let alone to me. I've only been here for a few days. my experience is that meditation is taught as the central practice. Rebirth is downplayed or not mentioned at all, and the Noble Eightfold Path is somewhere on the bookshelf as extra credit. Very difficult to get the full breadth of the path. Your perspective, thank you. My perspective is that go more to monastics. Yeah, I think this is one of the kind of the dangers of Buddhism in the West, that it is too lay-oriented. And lay-oriented Buddhism is tending to be more in that sphere of how lay people live their lives. Often you don't get the full story because basically, the commitment to the path is not as great for lay people. When that commitment is really strong to understanding the teaching of the Buddha, being a real disciple of the Buddha, taking this path all the way, which it is for a monastic, you're likely to get more of the real deal. I know a few monastics here in the US, and they are great people, and they're all very interested in the suttas. They all believe in rebirth. They're all interested in the Noble Eightfold Path. I just spoke to Venerable Analayo the other day. He's a wonderful monk. I agree with him almost on everything. It's very rare to find someone I agree with so much with as I agree with him. I've known him for a long time because we have corresponded a lot before and things. He's a wonderful example of that. Before that, I was at Empty Cloud Monastery down in New Jersey. Another beautiful place with a monk and a nun living down there with some lay people as well in the house. Great exponents of the Dhamma, into the suttas, into rebirth, into all the things that are important. Before that, I was in, I was in Chicago, didn't meet any monastics in Chicago, then Minneapolis, then I was in the Bay Area.
Sorry.
And in the Bay Area, I stayed, first of all, excuse me, in a nun's monastery called the Karuna Buddhist Vihara. Venerable Santusika and Venerable Chittananda, two wonderful monastics, really, really nice nuns. And they gave me a cutie and I stayed with them for a while. There was also a male presence, so I didn't stay just with the nuns. And again, very interested in the suttas, fully on board with rebirth, the Noble Eightfold Path, all of these things. Then I went to another monastery called Aranya Bodhi Monastery, where there's a nun called Ayatataloka, who leads a community of bhikkhunis. There's about 10 or something of them. Again, fully on board with all of these ideas. So monastics in general will give you the real deal. So that is why I think the monastic path is actually very important in Buddhism. And I remember many years ago, one of the kind of the people who here, who runs this place, Joseph Goldstein. Yeah, I've never met him, but I understand he was one of the people who started this place. And he was also very positive about monastics and say we need more monastics in the U.S. to put out the fire. Yeah, because the fire kind of, the monastics, I guess he considered us as a fire brigade or something, coming out to kind of hose down all the desires in the world. So I think this is important. I think, meditation is a very important part. Is it the central practice? Well, actually, the whole Noble Eightfold Path is a central practice. More foundational than meditation is morality. If you practice meditation without morality, meditation is going to stagnate. But if you practice morality without meditation, you're going to get benefits regardless. So morality is actually more important in that sense. Rebirth is downplayed, and that is very unfortunate because without rebirth, Buddhism collapses. There is no Buddhism. Those people who call themselves secular Buddhists, actually, by secular Buddhism, I mean those who reject rebirth, they are not really Buddhist at all, in my opinion, so they should call themselves secular. But it doesn't have a good ring just to call yourself secular, right? So you have to kind of, that's why they call themselves secular Buddhists. I'm probably upsetting some of those secular Buddhists by saying that. But you cannot really be a Buddhist without... What does it mean to be a Buddhist? It means to take refuge in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. Taking refuge in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha means that you take the word of the Buddha seriously. One of the planks, one of the foundations, one of the core things that keep the house of Buddhism upright is rebirth. It is one of the very basic elements in this whole house. Take that away, the whole house collapses. There is no Buddhism without rebirth. It doesn't make any sense anymore. So many of the core teachings are about this. So it is really, really important. So I hope that helps. So I'm going to go on to the next one because we still have many questions to go. Okay, so with metta to you, Ajahn. One. Is there a creation story in Theravada Buddhism? Is there a beginning here? So, okay, here we get to the... No, it's not really controversial. So is there a creation... There is a kind of creation story in Buddhism, and it is found in a sutta called the Aganya Sutta, in the Digha Nikaya, the long discourses of the Buddha, and it talks about how the universe begins. And how it starts with the collapse of the previous universe. It starts with the ending. The beginning starts with the ending. So the ending is there, the ending of the previous universe, and from that is the beginning of the present one. And that is kind of the Buddhist creation idea, right? So it begins with the ending and then a recreation. So there isn't any first point in Buddhism. And this is one of the things the Buddha says again and again in the suttas. He says there is no first point of rebirth. There is no first point of ignorance. There is no first point of craving. There is no first point, really, to anything. Yeah. You can always go back, and you go back in time. You can go further back and further back. Yeah, you can remember your past lives, and you can remember more past lives, and go back and back. No first point is discoverable, he says. He doesn't actually say outright that there is no first point, because the Buddha is a very pragmatic person. He works on the evidence that is available. So what he says is that if you go back in time, you cannot find a first point. That is quite different from making a metaphysical statement saying there is no first point. There's actually a big difference there. So because the Buddha works on the evidence that is available, he says you cannot discover a first point. So this is the Buddhist idea. So in other words, because there is no discovery of a first point, there is no need for a creator, right? Creation doesn't happen. What creates the universe? Well, actually craving creates the universe. What is the universe anyway? The universe, my universe is my experience, right? I see all of you now. When I travel around, I see whatever I see. That is my world. And that is really the only world that is interesting. Your personal world. And that personal world is sustained and created and perpetuated by craving. So the world is created by craving in this way, because it really is only a personal world that really matters. Isn't there a world outside? What about the universe? What about everything else? Isn't there something out there? Well, you know, that is also in our experience. Is there anything outside of our experience? Maybe, but it's irrelevant. When the Buddha talks about the world, he means our personal world. That is the one that matters. So that is how things are perpetuated, recreated, and how they carry on. And no first point can be found. So in Buddhism, there is no creator. That is completely irrelevant. In fact, the Buddhist idea of how the world works, to me, is the only really plausible idea. Creator God, does it make any sense to have a creator God? To me, it makes no sense. It doesn't explain anything, right? Okay, you go back and back in time, and then you say a creator God kind of started everything. But what about that creator God? You might as well say the universe goes further back. What difference does it make if a creator God made it or the universe kind of goes back in time? It doesn't explain anything. It seems like something that has been artificially imposed on the world. And anyway, how can we know that the creator God created the universe? Where does that knowledge come from? It's not something that we can ever know anyway. It is beyond our knowledge, because it would have to be outside of the universe, outside of our experience. So it kind of sounds like a human-made idea, right? What else could it be? It's a story, right? It's a human-made idea, because you can never actually know these things. Well, what about if God comes and tells you, I created the universe? Well, who is that? What is that thing that tells you that? Does he actually know, or it know, what it's talking about? Maybe it's a delusion. There's a nice story in the suttas. Yes, so many nice stories in that. So this is a story, I don't know if you heard this story, it's from the Brahmajala Sutta, the first sutta in the long discourses of the Buddha. And this is the story of how the creator God idea comes about. This is one way it comes about. You know that story, anyone? No, don't know it? Okay, so this is going to be really interesting for you to hear this story. You know the story? I don't know. You probably know this story. If you've been around for a long time, yeah. So... So this is the story of, this is kind of similar to what we're talking about in the Aganya Sutta, right? The universe starts after the previous universe comes to an end. And when the universe starts, there is nothing, it's very undifferentiated. Everyone is just living in bliss, because the coarse aspects of the universe, the kind of, you know, the earth and the beings, all of these kind of things, hasn't really appeared yet. So everyone is just feeding on joy, traveling through the air, and nothing much is happening in that universe. And then that universe starts to evolve. And when it evolves, there is a lower realm arising, and this lower realm is the Brahma Loka, where all the Brahmas hang out. And this is kind of a very, very high realm from our perspective. But from the perspective of the early universe, it's one level down compared to where they are. So a being gets reborn in that realm. It gets reborn in what is called an empty Brahma mansion. I don't know, it probably makes Versailles look like kind of a, a kind of a tiny hut in the forest, the Brahma mansion. You can imagine what it's like. So it would be something really magnificent, incredibly powerful at this point, these beings, and very happy and luminous and all of these kind of things. And then after hanging out in this Brahma mansion for, long period of time, he thinks, oh, it's a bit lonely. I haven't seen anyone for millions of years. We think COVID is lonely, it lasts for a few years, but this kind of millions of years seeing no one, okay, getting a bit lonely. It would be nice if someone came here to visit me so we could hang out together, we could have a conversation about how delightful it is to live here or whatever it is. And so then once after this being has this thought, someone else dies from that higher realm and gets reborn there, right? And then because that other being gets reborn there, after the first being had that wish, the first being thinks, yeah, I created this other being, right? Because I had the wish, then it got created into this existence. Then what happens is that second being that arose in that realm dies before the first being that got reborn there. And when it dies, it gets reborn as a human being, right? When it gets reborn as a human, you may think this is a bit far-fetched, but anyway, forget about whether it's far-fetched or not. This is an interesting story. It gets reborn as a human being. When it gets reborn as a human being, it becomes a nun or a monk, meditates, remembers past lives, and what does it remember? It remembers being created in that heavenly realm, right? There is a creator God. Why? Because I remember being in that heavenly realm. There was someone there before me. They created me. And so there is a creator God. So this is the Buddhist idea of how the kind of idea of a creator God arises in the world. So what do you think? Does that seem plausible? I don't know. That's the story there. I think the main purpose of the story is not necessarily to be realistic. I don't know. Maybe these things can happen. But I think that's not the main point. The main point is to show that these ideas can arise for all kinds of reasons that have nothing to do whether actually there is a creator God or not. I think it's fairly obvious that very often these things are just man-made. What else could they be? How could they arise without being man-made? To me, that's the only possible solution, really. Anyway, let's put that to one side. Oh, I have to go faster. I'm not going to go beyond 9 o'clock, so maybe we can. If I don't finish them all, we can do some more of them tomorrow. Okay, Ajahn Brahmali, do say anything when you bow to the Buddha. Do you say anything when you bow to the Buddha? That's what you're saying, I think. Is there a specific amount of vows that one should do? We don't really make vows as such, in Buddhism. A vow means like you undertake something that you will never break. But in Buddhism, it's more like training rules. We do our best, but we understand our human fallibility. And then when we make mistakes, we kind of confess and then we carry on. That's the Buddhist idea. To make vows is to think that we have more powers than we actually have. We don't have the power to make vows because we're not perfect enough to do that. So the vows that you should do, or really the precepts you should undertake, are the 5 precepts. Not to kill, not to steal, not to commit sexual misconduct, not to lie, and not to take intoxicants. These are the 5 basic precepts. Beyond that, live with kindness. General kindness, that is the vow you need. If you need one vow, the vow of kindness. You put hands in Anjali Mudra, raise them to your forehead, and then the heart chakra. Yes, you can do that. You put your hands in the Anjali, and when you bow to the Buddha, you can make a determination to keep these 5 precepts, to make it a bit more firm if you like. That may be useful. And sometimes people like to come to monastics and take the 5 precepts. Because when you do it in front of someone, it's like your determination is a bit more strong. So if you wish to do that, I'd be very happy to kind of give you the 5 precepts or whatever. So whatever. Yeah, so at the end of the retreat, if anyone wishes to take the five precepts, please come up and we can do that. Okay, so let's go on to the next one. Dear Ajahn, could you please tell us about some of the amazing people you have met since becoming a monk? I've already spoken a little bit about that. But the most amazing person I met since becoming a monk is the Buddha. I met him in the suttas. He's there. Yeah? He's a cool character here. There's a nice word in Pali called Siti Butto. Siti Butto means become cool. It's one of the epithets of the arahant. The arahant has become cool, right? Doesn't need any sunglasses or anything like that. You become cool merely by your presence, the higher kind of coolness. But I think that would be nice as a monk to take that name, yeah, Siti Butto, the cool one. Wouldn't that be nice? Kind of gives that nice double meaning here. Anyway, so dear Ajahn Brahmali, thank you for coming to BCBS. This is a question about reconciling teachings I received at an Ajahn Shah branch, in quotation marks, Forest Monastery, and those from our discussion here, and those from Ajahn Brahm. At that monastery, several Ajahns repeatedly spoke to the theme of consciousness as constant, unchanging, and essentially what we really are, as opposed to worldly phenomena, which is changing and unreliable. They urged me to almost take refuge in this consciousness awareness. This feels contradictory to Ajahn Brahm's teachings, that both the doer and the knower are not self, and the mind consciousness is subject to cessation in the arupa jhanas. We also spoke a bit about these topics. Can you help me make sense of these seemingly contradictory teachings? I may just be misunderstanding. Thank you. Right? Okay. Now we're getting really, really into the deeper things on this path. So in these cases, it is very hard to kind of, what are you going to do as a layperson? I can really understand this is where I'm kind of despairing. And you find different monks, and you may respect them all, or different nuns, or different teachers of whatever kind. And you may feel that there is this discrepancy. In these cases, the only thing we can do is to go back to the word of the Buddha. That's the only thing you can do. And then sometimes you find that there are different interpretations even of that, right? But I would say that if you read the word of the Buddha, I don't see how you can take a consciousness to be permanent. The Buddha specifically says that consciousness is impermanent. It depends on causes for its arising, right? And so to me, this whole idea that somehow consciousness can be, or awareness can be permanent, is just flies in the face of Buddhism. So what these monks actually mean, I don't know, but on the face of it, it seems to me to be a little bit troublesome, at the very least the way they say it. So again, but don't take my word for it, because I could very well be deluded. Who knows who is deluded? Read the suttas, read the word of the Buddha, take your stand on the word of the Buddha, because that is the gold standard for what the Dhamma is about. And then you're going to be on the right track. And even then, actually, it can be hard to kind of find your way through these things. So anyway, that's my understanding of this. I'm an Ajahn Brahm disciple, so you can imagine where I mean, there's a reason why I'm an Ajahn Brahm disciple, right? And to me, what Ajahn Brahm says matches very well with the suttas. And that's kind of where I take my stand. But make up your own mind. Investigate it for yourself, because it is always dangerous to just take someone's word for things. This is really good timing. I think we're going to just get this right. So if someone has a spouse and parents who are not Buddhists, what are some simple, skillful ways to explain the practice to them without coming across as trying to convert them? Are there things we can do to encourage them to be supportive of our practice? Well, the best way, and this is what I found in my own life, is to live the teachings. this is really, really powerful, because if they can see that you have changed and that you are doing things differently, that you are actually walking the talk rather than just talking, then usually that tends to have an impact on people. So do the teaching more than anything else. And sometimes what you have to do is that if you have a spouse and you have parents, well, very often, you know, you need someone with a degree of authority to actually convince someone of something. Yeah. And very often, if you are a child and you have parents, or even if you are in a relationship with someone for a long term, you may not have that authority with your parents to really be able to convince them that something is going on. We tend to get used to each other, take each other for granted a little bit too much, unfortunately, in long-term relationships. So sometimes you have to find some external authority that can help you to make these differences. So, you know, next time Ajahn Brahm is here in Barrie, well, that's next time, that may never, okay, that's kind of the wrong way of thinking about it. Maybe, you know, you can have an Ajahn Brahm book. Ajahn Brahm is very accessible. That's the nice thing about Ajahn Brahm. So get his book about who ordered the truckload of dung and kind of leave it around on the coffee table or something at random, right? And this is one of Ajahn Brahm's psychological techniques to get people to do things they don't actually normally do, right? So you put one of Ajahn Brahm's book on the coffee table and you tell your spouse or your parents, that is my book. No one else is to read that book. And when you say, no one else is to read it, that is going to become interesting, right? What do you mean, no one else is going to read it? You don't tell me what to do, right? And so you kind of hands off, right? But you still leave it there, right? Sort of put it a little bit away, so you kind of pretend. And this is kind of a ways to, tricky ways, right, to get people's attention. But Ajahn Brahm is a bit of, he's a kind of a, interesting character. So anyway, so little things like, oh, find someone who has some authority that they may listen to, right? And then Ajahn Brahm sometimes does come to North America. He goes to Toronto quite often because Toronto has a very large Buddhist community, very large community with Sri Lankan background from Toronto. Lots and lots of people there who are disciples of Ajahn Brahm. So sometimes he goes there and gives talks. That is not so far from here, Toronto, right? It's only a couple of hours of flight or something. So if you have a chance, maybe go. Let's tell your parents, let's go and check out this monk. He's a pretty cool character, right? Or maybe, whatever you think may work in terms of authorities. But sometimes you need an external authority for people to listen. And that is often the way to go. It was very interesting. I think one of the reasons why, many reasons why my parents started to listen to what I was doing was when they saw me as a Buddhist monk, right? And they saw other people respect me as a Buddhist monk. That kind of, wow, what's going on? People are respecting my son. Okay, maybe there's something worthwhile here, right? That's kind of interesting. Especially when I started to do YouTube videos, and that was on YouTube, and I thought, wow, a lot of people are watching him, yeah. And it's fascinating because they have a very worldly perspective on these things. So if many people are watching, maybe there's something worthwhile here. And so this is, these are the ways that kind of people get drawn into these things from a slightly worldly perspective. So we need to use that worldly perspective of authority or whatever it is to make these things work. Is there anything I can do to encourage them to be supportive of our practice? Well, basically, if you are kind and if you show that the Dhamma has a good effect on you, I think normally they will be very supportive. Ajahn Brahm tells the stories of people who go on retreats at our Buddhist society in Perth, and because they have a good time, they enjoy themselves, they come back. Their spouse is so happy, yeah, because they've become so gentle and kind and all of these kind of things on the retreat. And say, go on retreat more often, yeah. And they encourage them in the practice because of that. So just live in the right way, and they will be supportive. I think that is, you're doing a good thing when you live this life. Buddhism is really just a psychology of kindness, a psychology of understanding. It is not really a religion in the ordinary sense of the word. What are some details of the origins of the suttas? When were they first written down in Pali? How can we be sure that they are the word of the Buddha? This is a big question, and it's going to take me a long time to answer. And I am feeling a bit tired now, so if I think try to answer this now, I may not give a very good answer. So please forgive me, I will answer this tomorrow. So, is that all right? Yeah? And I will put it in here, and I promise you I will take it tomorrow, but for now I will put it back in the box, and we'll do it then. That is all for tonight. I wish you all a very good night's sleep again, and let's do the Buddhist chanting that we did yesterday tonight. Are you ready for that? I will lead it like we did yesterday, just to pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha before we call it a day.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.